CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Reports. I'm Jonathan.
And Ramon is present. How are you, Witt?
Yeah, I'm doing well. We're recording this a bit early, so in this essentially we're leaving it behind after the apocalypse. When there's nothing left, this podcast will still be hopefully available as a primer to a bit more libertarianism. Not libertarianism, liberty.
Liberty. Concept. Right. Apparently that's what we're gonna talk about.
Well, somewhat.
Says two people who do this for free. In an oppressive studio in Rivonia. Let's talk about liberty.
Completely. Well, we're not oppressed, Ramon. We're not oppressed. Stop. Although you're an Arab, so I suppose you can pull it off, eh?
Please don't identify me. I self-identify.
Are you male today? Are you gender fluid?
I self-identify as a Sherman tank. And if you disagree with that, you're a bigot.
I don't know if you saw Gad said that his... the correct gender pronoun was, and it was basically just he went wild on his keyboard. It was like,
oh, really?
On the keyboard with a whole bunch of letters and numbers.
Woman. Yeah. Do you know how to say that? Cecilia, do you know how to say that? Before we introduce you, do you know how to say that?
I don't know how to say it. I have no idea.
What kind of woman are you?
As you can hear, we have a woman in the studio. She may not be a woman, depending on how she feels today.
Right.
Let me introduce her.
So it's Cecilia Koch. We actually studied law together at WITS few years ago.
Yes.
And so, yes.
What's WITS? Sorry, for those people who can't remember.
If you go back in history, if you want to see where the most millionaires came from, they went to this one place.
Called WITS.
Yeah, in Bramfontein.
Okay. Doesn't exist anymore. Hey?
And they were imbued with propaganda about the state, and then they paid the state a lot of money afterwards. That was WITS. So, Cecilia, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's so nice to be with you guys.
We can talk a lot of shit on the show, but yeah, that's why you're here.
Thanks.
Not to talk shit.
I'm quite good at talking shit.
Oh, right. Okay. Brilliant. So, tell us a little bit about what you do.
I studied law, that's right, with you a while back, and decided that is not where I saw myself.
Because you're a nice human. And basically lawyers are like scum of the earth.
No,
well, less because of that, but because I felt like it didn't fit into the kind of life that I imagined myself to live or into my idea of the good life.
Mm.
I ended up actually kind of by chance, an international NGO that promotes constitutional democracy, human rights, the rule of law, and a freer market economy. And we do that all over the world.
So basically neoliberal propaganda.
That's us, yeah. Unfortunately.
And you fund this,
evil.
Of course. So,
of course.
So you are, as we have discussed off air, you are the third force.
Right. Should be really scared of us.
Right.
So what do you look for? I mean, what do you mean by free markets and what is being a liberal? What does that entail?
Oh, that is a really deep question and an enormous question. And I wouldn't quite know where to start, except for the fact that I have sort of been delving into a lot of John Stuart Mill lately, who is one of my absolute intellectual heroes. And I think who's also known as the father of modern liberalism. And basically, his book on liberty, I think, outlines for me, I think, the most important thing of what it means to be a liberal, which is basically that all sort of individuals ought to be able to develop to their full potential in their lives. And that's something that I fully believe in. That's a wonderful place to start because he talks about how we need to guard against the tyranny of the magistrate, so the tyranny of the state. And of course, he asks us to guard against tyrannies of certain other institutions such as the church or the despotism of custom. And so he asks us to guard against the tyranny of the majority as well. And that's a big one. I think it's a kind of a big one for us today is to guard against mainstream opinion that is really oppressive.
Well, we've got that. We've got the tyranny of the is it the majority or the loud minority? What have we got going?
Empirically, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think John Stuart Mill would be fine with us guarding against the tyranny of a minority as well, which I think in this case might be apt. We just don't know what the numbers are, you know, what people really...
Well, 23% it fits. We have that number.
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, we have, for example, I think in the media or certainly in sort of public discourse, certain opinions that are very sort of stridently put forward. And if you disagree with them, you are called all sorts of things that I'm sure you've been called a couple of times too.
What have we been called? I can't remember.
I know. What
have you got? Have you got a list?
Is this a start into dementia? Is this where it begins? it gets worse for people who don't buy into the identity that they're meant to buy into. So we get called names, but they're kind of the names you'd expect us to get called because of what our perceived identity is by the people calling us names. Mm. If you, for example, you know, we've had Sikhle on the show before, he's a good friend of ours. If you, for example, are Sikhle and you don't buy into Fees Must Fall, as he doesn't, then you're an Uncle Tom, as he got called recently.
If you're very polite, I think he's the Renegade Report house nigger. Someone else called him that.
Yeah, okay, so I think we need to clarify.
What's nice about Sikhle, he actually takes those on the chin. He's like, yeah, so what?
Yeah, no, look, he doesn't care because he also gets that words... You know, words are just words.
Yeah.
They're not the end of the world. But what do you think about the collectivist sort of identities, the identity politics? Let's go into all of that.
Okay, well, I think that stands very much in the way of individuals truly being able to flourish. And I think a lot of it comes down to, these identity... Well, I think that, unfortunately, what seems to be happening is sort of a re-racialization of society. So I think one of the greatest evils, for example, of a regime like apartheid was that people weren't seen as individuals. They were robbed of their individuality and instead were seen to be part of a group that seemed to share, I don't know, certain or other, some other features. And so that's hugely problematic. So I'm supposed to be writing a master's thesis at the moment, which I'm just not doing because I find a million different things to do instead.
That's the story of doing a master's.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
Basically, anyone who gets a master's or a PhD has fought off procrastination.
What are you talking about? Every single YouTube video is extremely interesting.
That's right. Exactly. And like every person's Facebook comment needs to be read, right?
The fails of 2016, yeah.
But I suppose the question that I'm looking at for my thesis is the following. What role should the racial identity of an individual play in the moral assessment of that particular individual's actions? And right now, it seems to be the case that a lot of people think it ought to play a big role, right? So if, for example, we have Action X, and Action X is performed by a so-called white person as opposed to a so-called black person, it can be morally evaluated very differently. It's seen very differently, right? So, like, I'm sure lots of people have said to you, you guys, you have no authority to speak on such and such topic because you guys are white males, which puts you at the very bottom of the pile. So I'm interested in what this kind of thing does to the people that it aims to be uplifting or helping. And in fact, I think it's hugely problematic. So the explanations I've received for this kind of stance is the following, that basically it's because of these people's disadvantage or structural disadvantage and victimization that certain people's voices ought to be louder and, you know, have heavier than
more,
others.
More merit exactly. Is given to them. Yeah.
Exactly. On the basis of this disadvantage and whatnot. But the problem is that then what you're doing is you're creating a stereotype. So the moment you see someone black, you know, there's all this presumed stuff that may or may not be there. So there again, what you're doing is creating stereotypes and there's a stigmatization around people purely on the basis of this overt marker that is race.
So it's the same removing of identity. It's the same thing apartheid would have done. It would have said all black people are X, treat all black people the same because they're X, right?
Okay. That's right.
Okay, this might get a bit too hyperbolic. But the question I've been asking, I've been wrestling with this question. How important is experience?
Right.
Or lived experience, as they call it today.
Yeah.
Because maybe there are some things we are not aware of. And I think that is completely legitimate.
Absolutely. So lived experience is a really interesting term because it seems to often be used in a very strange way when you know, there is no such thing as the universal lived experience, right?
Right.
And philosopher Kwame Anthony Appiah, who I'm sure you're aware of, recently gave a lecture, I think it's the BBC Wraith lecture, in which he sort of went on about how, you know, racial identities are, well, biological nonsense. And from that position flow a whole bunch of consequences that you have to then accept. Basically, yeah, the lived experience thing. So he says, you know, being black in the Bronx is a very different experience to, you know, being black in Ghana. Your experience will be very different. And I do think that there is something to treating people differently or treating people in a specific way because of their lived experience. Mm-hmm. So say, for example, battered woman syndrome, right? So where we would normally convict someone of murder, we wouldn't do so with a battered woman, well, with a woman who has battered woman syndrome because of her lived experience. So we're looking then really at the lived experience and not necessarily just at the, well, you're not looking at the person's skin color. So you can't assume anything from the skin color. And you're not looking at the woman qua woman. So not just, you know, the woman,
yes,
as a woman.
You're looking, itself, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, seem to cut myself off. Are you looking at the specific situation?
Yes.
The problem with the way lived experience is used is that it's used to describe one individual and then extrapolated to the entire group.
Yes, exactly.
And that's the issue with it today.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, I mean, stereotypes, they are bad, regardless of whether they might be seen to be positive stereotypes or negative. So there is this thing about, you know, Asians being good at maths or whatever.
So you can't say, like, the Jews are good at, you know, commerce and shit.
No, yeah. No, because you're taking away from people's individuality. You're taking away from their uniqueness and from the sense,
yes,
that they may not be
good, I mean, at commerce. I'm an exception. I can't cook for shit. Apparently the French can cook really well. I'm not one of them. And I actually blame my lived experiences in Africa because the food here is awful.
Bullshit, we've got good food,
man. I just came back from Paris.
No, okay, that's different.
You can't compare.
Well, yeah.
So for lived experience.
That's nice for you.
Exactly.
And your lived experience.
This is my
beautiful
show. This is my show. I won't let a woman speak to me on my show.
All right,
it's
okay,
a woman.
Cool.
Get it right.
Okay,
a
woman. Here we go with, okay, more epistemic injustice.
the patriarchy is relevant in the studio.
Right.
So lived experience has a point to it.
Yes.
But on an individual basis.
Yes.
You would argue.
Yeah.
I would think. I think,
yeah,
that's your argument.
I would argue that. And so say, for example, if someone, you know, goes traveling quite a bit, again, they are, you know, not white, but look kind of Arabish. In fact, I'm thinking of a very particular person, and he often talks about himself being misraced. So people assume him to be from a particular race, which he isn't. And this leads to him being stopped and searched and, you know, interrogated on all his travels. And finds the whole situation rather odd, but I mean, the point is that ultimately, like, if he were, for example, to lash out and, you know, I don't know, hit some guard in the face, you know, he wouldn't have the authority to do that on the basis of a skin color alone. It would be because he was badly treated or treated unfairly or whatnot on,
right,
the, you know, on the basis of skin color. But it's not on the skin color as such. It's,
yes,
there's other stuff going on. If you
because
know
I also
I mean.
Want to ask one day, well, if we get like a black nationalist in here, which I do hope we will one day. So if we understand the experience of black people in general, of unprocessed trauma from apartheid, which I can sort of accept as an argument, why is the lived experience of a white Afrikaner who is fearful of the blacks for being violent or whatever the case might be, why is that experience not given as much merit as another's experience? So as a farmer, right? So you were held up and tortured by black individuals. Your lived experience is one of fear of black people, right?
Yeah, except it,
so why is that one given less charitable interpretation than a black person's experience?
Possibly because of the context. So, you know, in apartheid, the general sort of situation was such that, you know, the black majority was oppressed.
Yes.
So often, you know, I suppose it would be argued that potentially violence could be justified because of this white minority that was oppressing and brutalizing sort of the black majority, even if it's not the case in this particular farmer's instance.
Mm. Right.
I mean, I might say that you probably would take the white farmer on that view, not because, so he can have the view based on his lived experience, but you would challenge him on his view because his view is wrong because, once again, it doesn't think about people as individuals.
Yes.
Equally, you would take on the guy throwing stones at the Great Hall at Wits, because, you know, all white people are oppressing him, or some such other thing that you, kind of thing that had been said in the discourse. You'd equally take him on for the exact same reasons.
I think both positions are wrong.
Yeah.
But in the general discourse, one is given far more weight than another.
Yeah.
So even the lived experience argument is relative.
Yes.
That's basically what I'm trying to say.
Okay. Yeah. No.
Yeah. Yeah.
The relativism is a huge issue, isn't that?
Sure.
Isn't that one of the biggest problems with the application of a lot of these things? I think people in general, you know, we want a better society. We want people to treat each other better. Mm. I think where, you know, the patriarchy, for example, you know, where there is, I don't buy into rape culture, but where you have a campus where, for example, things are happening that are not acceptable in terms of the treatment of women, that is absolutely something that needs to be taken on, challenged, and dealt with. Mm. But it's the sort of relativism that crops up, whereby it's we take things that aren't really what they're made out to be, and we then I don't know if I'm being clear.
No, I have no idea what you're saying.
Well, I mean, So when you say, you know, there are obviously problems, and we need to, you know, recognize them and deal with them, but. And this is what I really like about Jonathan Haidt's work, is he looks at how people then want to deal with them, right? So say, for example, there was a problem, you know, violence against women and whatnot. A lot of the measures that are put in place then center around the identity of the woman or whatnot, instead of, you know, looking at the root causes of the violence and trying to sort those out. We're looking at identities, and what happens is, so I suppose he talks about these sort of identity enclaves that then develop, where, for example, there's women's groups and there's like microaggression training and that kind of thing, and that sows so much disharmony, actually, and does exactly the opposite of what it claims to be doing.
Yeah. Jonathan Haidt makes a point that the social sciences specifically who fracture people into a women's groups or a queer-only group or whatever else group, that actually causes far more distress in the society than otherwise.
Yeah, and I think it has, you know, very sort of consequences that aren't considered. So you might know that if you protect certain groups, people will break into those groups. You might know that that's going to be an outcome. But men's rights activists, for example, that is the response.
Worst, the worst people on earth.
Sure. Well, I don't know about the worst people on earth.
Okay.
But
feminists first.
Third way.
That's exactly the point, is the protection of sort of third wave feminist ideals and principles have created the complete opposites, who are just as bad, in men's rights activists.
Well, even now, it's social justice warriors and in the alternative right, as they call themselves.
Yeah, the alt-right, yeah.
Sort of like subversive white nationalists, Pepe the Frog characters. They're a bit odd, like in every single way. But
an ugly frog.
Going back to liberalism, I mean, we would accept both these groups and call them both idiots. One would hope.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that those kind of group identities really do seem to sort of stand in the way of a person discovering really who they are and the kind of, you know, and being able to then to construct the kind of life that they, you know, that allows them to flourish fully as a unique individual, the very, you know, unique path to follow in life.
So, but you're assuming that humanity has value of sorts. I think that's the essence of liberalism, right? Humanity has value. Individuals have value.
Yes.
And must sort of leave them alone to try to find their own type of value.
Well, you want to create the kind of conditions in which a valuable life can be led. Because if you think about it, I mean, that's all we have in this world, right? We have this little life that is squished between birth and death. And you kind of want to make the best of it on this planet while you can. I mean, that's ultimately what I think we want to do. So yeah, meaning of life, creating meaning in life. Yes. Yeah. I think that's quite an important thing to be after.
Yeah. So then you would be an anarchist then.
Oh, here we go again.
Okay, at least I have Jonathan in my camp here.
Last time I was beaten. Yeah, because I think the state is the greatest obstruction to human evolution, so to speak.
Are we really going to have this conversation?
Yeah, it's an arbitrary notion of power that we buy into, and then we've got different psychopaths telling us to vote for them, and have you good.
Are you the kind of libertarian that doesn't even believe that we need to have police and rule?
Well, he can't be a libertarian then.
Well, you can, but it would just be sort of very limited.
He's not even a libertarian. Yeah, let's go back to the ideas and sort of good ideas, bad ideas. Okay. You wrote a whole piece on ideas.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that. Those of you who haven't read it, it is available on Politics Web. But give us a bit of a summary.
That's right. It's called Poisoning the Well. I wrote it one afternoon while I was procrastinating. This was by far the most productive procrastination I've ever done. This is not usually the case. But I suppose I was triggered to write the piece because of a Facebook post. I can't even remember exactly what the Facebook post was about, but it had something to do with, you know, the university situation in the country. And I was also triggered by a passage that I'd read by my external reader of my thesis proposal. And I wrote this piece, I think, in response to sort of the decolonization rhetoric, because I find it really strange or really unfortunate that ideas seem to be tied to the people who are putting them forward or who have put them forward. So I think it's very strange to try and evaluate an idea based on where the idea first originated or where it was first sort of documented. So I think the beautiful thing about ideas is their universal nature. And, you know, the only reason to get rid of ideas, I think, is when they're bad. And that's an objective sort of thing that you can assess. But, you wouldn't be fallaciously looking at the source of the idea in order to get rid of the idea, but rather the merits of the idea itself.
So Newton came up with gravity. Gravity is a objective fact that we now know. And the mathematics behind that is pretty solid. Mm. So just because it's Newton doesn't mean we throw the idea of gravity out the window or we attack the idea.
Okay, yeah, but that's an easy example. What happens if,
well, they gave it to me. What do you want me to do?
No, that's a very easy
working
one.
With what I'm given.
So, yes, because there are so few people who articulate exactly what they think when they talk about the term decolonization.
But what about if we had a proper Nazi who had evidence to show that Jews are X or Y or whatever the case might be in a negative light, would that idea still be valid?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean
that's where your theories or your writings must be tested.
Yes,
right? We can talk about Newton.
So what you have to then do really is dissect, you know, exactly that claim and, you know, just double check it for its veracity, because certainly, you know, you can sort of look to the source of an idea to maybe get a sense of the interests that particular person may have or the group may have, but still in evaluating the idea, you'll want to try and discard all of that because you just want to look at the merit of the idea.
I'm trying to remember, I can't remember the guy's name, but there's a guy in the US who found some research, someone did some research, but his background is that he's a pretty racist kind of guy.
Yeah.
And they went and did some research.
Isn't
which
it Crick, the guy from
no,
the
no,
DNA?
It's not, no, it's not Crick. That Crick whole thing was debatable, but there's a guy who went and basically he put together some data which showed black people to be inferior. Okay. And then he went and obviously ran with the data, you know, because now it supports his racist views. Mm. And he runs with it. And I think that's where I hear what you're saying, but you have to evaluate, the idea, in its
sure.
whole
and, in itself,
and,
yeah.
And then it wouldn't even if you could say that let's use your example something bad about Jews even if you could say that that wouldn't allow you to then go and sort of exterminate that group of people.
Mm. No, but say a Nazi scientist has like a perfect double-blind experiment to show that Jews are intellectually inferior. And all he wants to show is that. He doesn't want like, to annihilate them.
So I think when we're dealing with something like a Nazi or this racist guy, you know, it would certainly tend to indicate that there is this interest in pushing a particular narrative, which would make you particularly cautious in accepting, you know, whatever, the double-blind experiment. I mean, ultimately, what you do want to do is then put that to one side. And I suppose you want to sort of examine every claim as rigorously as possible. But yeah, in these particular cases,
No, there's too much time. There's not enough time in the day. I'd rather just make a flippant conclusion in my own mind before I actually see any evidence. It works very well for me, I must be honest.
Oh, dear.
Then you just pick up your gun or whatever traditional weapon you can find and just get to work.
There we go.
Indeed. That's how it works.
I am getting out of the studio.
I think, though, you can believe whatever you want. You can have any ideas you want, good and bad, proven and unproven. Mm-hmm. It's how you choose to act on those views and how they, if you're going to kind of interfere with other people.
Yeah. So that takes us back to John Stuart Mill and the harm principle.
All right. So let's talk about interfering with people. You wrote something many years ago on BE and how we can, you said we could do non-racial BE.
Non-racial affirmative action.
Ah, okay, okay. Yeah. Well, the difference being?
Well, black economic empowerment implies that it's going to be racial. Because it's got the term black.
The proxy of the affirmative action is
race.
Is race.
Yes.
All right. Well, it was originally affirmative action, and then they needed to change the name. I don't know. Maybe.
Well, it was always a racial.
Maybe
racial
Tokyo didn't like it, or Cyril didn't like the name, and it didn't look nice on the document they were signing.
Cyril didn't like it. He certainly didn't let his feelings be known. Quietest man in politics I've ever met, or haven't met.
You would be too if you were earning billions of deals. So how do we do? How do we do non-racial
affirmative action?
Well, in a nutshell, what you do is you look at a basket of socioeconomic indicators to point to disadvantage, because the whole reason why, you know, this form of affirmative action exists is to try and sort of compensate for past injustice, which is absolutely necessary. And another couple, I suppose, of reasons for affirmative action is sort of correction for current injustice. And another reason that's cited for the existence of affirmative action is diversity. But yeah, basically you'd look at a basket of socioeconomic indicators. And the reason why this is better than looking at race is because firstly, you know, now we're in 2016, race isn't necessarily the best proxy for disadvantage. And if benefits are allocated on the basis of race, this means that, you know, very wealthy people who actually don't need a leg up, you know, are potentially getting a leg up when this is just not necessary for them. And these guys may also act as gatekeepers in the sense that their children, who then also go on to, you know, fancy schools and end up at really fancy overseas universities and whatnot and come back, also get this leg up, which they don't need. And generally, the point is that often people who really would need it are being overlooked. And the problem is also, I think, in corporate culture, you know, you want someone who, at least this happens a lot, is this phenomenon of mirroring, basically where you want to employ someone who sort of looks like you, speaks like you. So the kid who went to, you know, St. John's with my kid, you know, I'll pick this kid, you know, because I know him and yeah, he comes over, you know, you know, for dinner and whatever twice a week. But the guy who's really worked super hard to get the kind of good marks, perhaps not brilliant marks, but really good marks, especially given the fact that he had no, I don't know, extra tuition that, you know, maybe the other kid did have. You know, he maybe doesn't speak like the St. John's boys, but he certainly got the determination and the willpower and the ability to sort of stick it out. And these are all like amazing qualities that you want in your employees. But all these things sort of get overlooked because sort of race is the central criterion. Another big problem with having race as your proxy for disadvantage is you can't really tell, you know, when transformation has occurred. You can measure socioeconomic progress, but you can't, I mean, your skin color is your skin color and there's nothing you can do about it. And that sort of leads me to another problem with it is that you are forever going to bear this overt sign of, you know, disadvantage or whatnot. And it actually often undermines the very people it sort of claims to be helping, because
well, it's deeply patronizing.
Well, there's the stigma around the, you may well be by far the best candidate for the job, but you know there will always be this assumption that you got your job
because you get the job, and even though you perfectly are qualified for the job, in fact maybe overqualified for the job, the reason you got it is nothing to do with your merit.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think we've spoken about the problem that creates in not acknowledging people's merit. The other issue, I mean, I was going to say, well, look, in South Africa, we know that, you know, the majority of people that are disadvantaged are black, so you can use being black as a sort of marker.
Very lazy marker.
But over time, it probably becomes a worse marker. You know, we know now from a previous show we've done, the black middle class is now larger than the white middle class, and it's growing rapidly.
Well, even the upper class.
Sure. It's growing rapidly. We also, I don't know if we've discussed it on air, but someone, Ramon and I, have had a discussion with, it said in 20 to 30 years' time, you know, the percentage of population that the white people make up will probably be less than 1%. So at some point, you kind of, it becomes an irrelevant marker, because probably the majority of the country will be black. So then if you're trying to benefit black people, you're trying to benefit everyone, really. which might not be a bad idea from the government's perspective. But if you've got a specific system aimed at benefiting certain people, that's a pointless marker to use.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose another big issue, so say, for example, if you have, you know, in this country, you've got quotas for public schooling, or, you know, in municipalities and whatnot, to deliver sort of basic services to the very poor, because the wealthier classes can afford to opt out of the state service provision and can afford private medical aid, private schooling, all that kind of thing. But if you have this quota system for the poorest of the poor, and these guys are the ones who are relying on sort of state services, and, you know, say, for example, you don't fill the positions because you just don't find the right people or whatnot, then you have, you know, you're entrenching disadvantage. Whereas, in fact, your claim is to try and get rid of disadvantage, but in actual fact, you're entrenching it, because you may not, for example, be appointing people. So you may just be keeping those spots vacant, or you may be appointing people on the basis of, it's obviously, quotas are a much sort of stronger race-based policy than, for example, sort of strong preference policies. And then you may just be depriving the very poor of the kind of education that they deserve. And so you're actually entrenching disadvantage there.
Sorry, I'm missing. Have we spoke about the solution yet?
Yeah, I was just about to get there. Okay, but please don't say get rid of the state.
No, hold on.
Thanks, Hitler. We can say that that's the final solution.
Jonathan, please. Cecilia's solution.
Oh, no, I think we have already touched upon that, and that is really looking at a basket of socioeconomic indicators. So perhaps, you know, what your parents did, how much income your household receives.
Why don't you just do a simple means test?
Well, that's basically it, right?
I've written this paper.
But you may also want to look at the types of schools that you've gone to, and all that kind of thing. And you may want to also then look at merit, as I already sort of touched on earlier, in a different way. So say, for example, you know, you have a kid who gets a C in maths in a township school, in spite of the fact that he has to walk, you know, 5 km to and from school every day, and, you know, hasn't really got electricity, but has to study it by candlelight. He gets a C, which is an incredible achievement compared to, say, for example, a kid who has extra maths 3 times a week.
And all the amenities.
Exactly. So you may want to sort of relook at how you understand merit, because that's merit based, because you're looking at merit
Do you think we need a policy as affirmative action in the guise that you say? Do you think we still need that if we had a free market? Because there seems to be a bit of a irreconcilable difference here. You're for free markets and liberalism. Affirmative action. Or are you just saying,
I don't think it's irreconcilable.
Our notion of affirmative action is wrong. If we had to have it, this is the way to have it.
There is need for redress based on past wrongs. So, you know, if people were wronged in the past, there should be some kind of compensatory action. And in fact, these past wrongs may carry quite far into the future. So, you know, what happened to your parents under apartheid may well affect you, you know, and where you are in life currently.
Definite, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And what school you're attending and, you know, what kind of opportunities are available to you.
Okay.
And so ultimately, as a liberal, I care about equality of opportunity. And I feel like that's just not, you know, the case, is that there is.
How do we get there? So how do we get there? Your opinion, I'm not asking for, you know, the all the different policies, the NGO you work for and all that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, perhaps a non-racial sort of affirmative action or some sort of leg up for people that come from really difficult backgrounds so that mm-hmm. we sort of equal the playing fields for opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
How else do we get there? Because we've got a situation currently where, so what you're doing is that sort of policy would be a middle, somewhere in the middle of life. You know, was it France or someone previously who said, you know, trying to target people when they're 40 years old, mm. Is pointless.
Mm.
You know, if you want to target the problem, then target the problem at the root. So,
yeah.
For example, if you want to stop the kid from having to study under candlelight, give him freaking electricity.
Mm.
You know, if you want to improve, make sure that he can get an A in maths
mm.
and be equal to the kid at the good school,
mm.
Give him a better school.
Yeah.
So, how do we get there? I mean, do you feel we're living in a liberal country? Do we really practice liberal values?
Mm.
Is liberalism the way to get to a truly liberal society? So do we have to go another way first to get to being liberals, perhaps?
Well, I mean, I think there are two massive problems standing in the way of people being able to live fulfilling lives. And I think one of them is the state of our basic education system. So, or, you know, of our primary and secondary education systems, you know, and then obviously we've got problems in the tertiary education system as well. I think what really needs to happen is a total reform of the schooling system. Franz Cronier from the Institute of Race Relations has this wonderful slide in the presentation that he sort of gives. And I think you guys have referenced it a couple of times on your podcast as well.
We've never met him.
Don't know who you're talking about.
Where he tracks, you know, a particular class from grade 0 to grade 12.
Yes.
And then, you know, right through to university. It is utterly depressing to see how many kids fall off, you know, and just disappear out of the schooling system.
About 650,000 out of a million from grade 1 to matric, roughly, are the figures.
Exactly. Those are the guys that don't make it to matric.
Mm.
And then, obviously, you know, the ones who then get a matric, you know, some of them get a matric with a 30% pass in maths. I mean, a 30% pass in maths, you know. If it is your dream to become an engineer or whatnot, that is going to be a grueling thing to get through at university if you've been, you know.
Well, impossible.
Able... Yeah. And,
I got 51% in maths in matric. Standard grade, but no one needs to know.
But so there's that massive massive problem, and I mean youth unemployment is extremely high. If you look at the numbers, I think from like the ages between 15 and 24, you've got youth unemployment of over 60%, which is just enormous. So Race Relations actually recently released a report on youth, and youth being the sort of powder keg, and it really is disastrous. And in addition to that, you know, you've got an economy that requires very specific skills. So our economy is very, very much based on services. And this, interestingly enough, people don't really know. Do you guys, for example, know what the general makeup of our GDP is?
Mining and tourism.
So mining, you say 25?
Yeah. Mining.
Let's guess.
12%.
Yeah, I would have gone around 10%.
Mining.
Mining, yeah.
No, it's less. It's around 8. The crazy thing is that, you know, people always assume that somehow there will be jobs and there'll be jobs in certain sectors and whatnot. And
they
and
fall
if you
from
look
the
at
sky,
yeah, definitely. Guess how much sort of agriculture makes up of our GDP?
5%.
Less than 3.
Yeah, I would have said higher, but I know that we're importing food, so I suppose that just points to that.
Not necessarily, because it may just be the case that it's just very efficient kind of food production kind
of
thing.
Seasonal,
I mean, we also do have a drought at the moment, so there is that too.
Okay,
so what does services make up?
70%.
70%.
And the biggest chunk out of the services sector. Yeah. And the biggest chunk thereof is banking and finance and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
over 20%. So we need highly skilled people, and yet we have like a totally uneducated potential workforce. So you have these two, no skilled workforce, which is a massive disaster. And you've got the economy growing at the IMF's last forecast was 0.1%. So things aren't looking so good.
Well, that's what happens when you have a state.
All right, so our GDP is completely incorrect. Can we, in your opinion, do we think we can redirect so that we can use the sort of low-skilled people so we can at least try and uplift those people, give them jobs, get them getting an income? I mean, shouldn't we be putting money towards, mining, I think our time is done. And certainly with unions and things, the companies are now going towards automation, and they don't really want large workforces. But it would seem to me that it's not even intelligent, especially in a country that's about to arrest its finance minister, to have all your eggs in the finance basket.
I think it's arrested. It's really great. But is it don't we just have to fulfill basic needs of people first? Because that eliminates a whole lot of inequality, firstly, between, as we discussed, between the person who lives in the suburbs with electricity and running water versus the person who doesn't, with no electricity and no running water.
And bad education,
Education. Why don't you just fulfill basic services, as expressed by the constitution, well, there you go.
What a Freudian slip there for you.
The equality is much better there already. And then people are able to build their lives, so to speak, because their basic services have been met.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because so the Institute of Race Relations points to the ANC being incredibly successful in its service delivery, in actual fact. The amount of sort of RDP houses built and the amount of sort of electricity's role, all that kind of stuff.
They've done a good job.
Yeah, they've done a really good job in terms of all of that, in actual fact. I mean, even though some of it may be crumbling now, and you know, here and there there'll be outages. Obviously we have Eskom and all that sort of stuff to deal with too. But the problem is that there's still no way of sort of self-actualization, because you hit a ceiling. So those basic needs are fulfilled, right? But then where to from there? And so there's certainly a need for the economy to grow, for there to be more jobs, for people to be able to climb up the ladder and be economically mobile. There certainly is that need. Yeah, I mean, another aspect to this whole thing is that because of how stagnant our economy is at the moment, we're seeing so many violent sort of protests. And again, the Institute has pointed to like a almost perfect inverse correlation between a drop in household income and spike in violent protests. This whole thing is not looking very pretty.
Yeah. That's why universities must fall in the end. They're putting all these. No, I'm not trolling. Listen. We have a service-based economy where 50% of people are very badly skilled or low skilled. And people still think university is the answer to getting a job, but the jobs we actually need are manual labor jobs or something to that effect, or plumbing, or technical work.
Or agriculture.
It's not fucking learning how to put numbers together in a spreadsheet.
We need exactly more of those guys. Because if the economy is services heavy, then we are looking for guys who can fill those jobs.
But why must it be services heavy?
Unless you want to be a statist and an interviewer.
But it's like that for a reason.
The point I was getting to earlier, which was, do we feed the current system, which is, we're services-based, we're very financial sector-based. So what we really need is, actually, we should scrap the humanities, which would be a wonderful idea at this point.
Hey, they get such a bad rap.
They do get a bad rap.
Because
they came up with words unfairly, like decolonization.
But those are the bad faculties.
We know. So it's fine. We will take ethics, and we will take philosophy, and we will house them somewhere logical. And then we can shut everything down except for the commerce and economic sector.
No, but all you have to do is break the monopoly on education, to think that education is only available with a piece of paper from a university. And education is actually a variety of different things to different people and open up the market to different sort of education.
This is true. I mean, I think there is a need. I mean, certainly universities play a huge role, especially given the kind of economy that we have. But there is certainly a need for that kind of technical, very sort of specific training that, you know.
Right. More plumbers, more electricians, more farriers, more mechanics. Why are all the mechanics working at the fucking BMW in Rivonia, for God's sake?
Because it pays them to.
Why can't there be one like on every street corner? Like there's a spa on every street corner, but there's no mechanic. That makes no sense.
Well, you need the, as you know, you need the volumes for them to be able to open their business. You need people to be using them. And we're only going to do that by growing the economy.
Yeah.
And so that everyone has a car, basically. Mm. And everyone needs a mechanic on every street corner.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just wondering how we, if we can, so partially what you're saying, if we can, how we shift the economy there, how we get our economy away from being so centered. I mean, we must have been a mining economy at some point.
Well, I think there's, a big problem is also the policy uncertainty in certain areas. So I think in terms of what happens in the mining policy space is that there is enormous uncertainty and a really big sort of ministerial discretion. And that scares away
investment.
And what we really need is investment-led growth in various sectors.
All right. So then why are we supporting this bloody Pravin Gordhan? He's so anti-investment and anti-savings and anti-growth.
Because that's the remarkable. Same reason people are supporting Hillary.
But
it's the same reason, lesser of two evils.
No, he's not the lesser of two evils. He is prime evil.
He's the reason.
He's the reason we're going into junk status.
The boss is the reason we're going into junk status.
No, he controlled the finances for the first time for Jay-Z, right?
Yeah.
All he did was increase capital gains, increase transfer duty, increase estate duty, put sugar taxes. What the fuck has he done for growth and investment?
That was all his decision? You think he wasn't trying to?
He's a dirty commie bastard.
He wasn't trying to make sure that the guy at the top could continue to fund planes and houses and large cavalcades of cars.
That's happening anyway with Pravin there. So come on, don't be this moralistic.
I'm not a fan of Pravin.
I
think everyone needs
he's
to
a shocking
get
minister
over
of
like communist finance minister. But I think the guy at the top is a bigger problem.
I think there's also something to be said around the protection of his office. So it's a problem when, for example, you know, these charges are levied against him and they're baseless. Regardless of what you think about Pravin Gordhan, it's a problem.
But that's the ANC crumbling. I'm happy with that. The difference is, what about?
Ramon's happy to see it all burn.
No, but what about using SARS as a prosecutory authority against Julius Malema and all that? Yeah, it's not our friend, but for tax purposes, you want to send someone to jail, and he's the one who did it, right? It's ridiculous. Pravin's bad as a bad minister. So we need more growth in investment. Sorry, I had my rant. Last week was Lead SA. Today's Pravin. So need more growth and investment. Yeah. So i.e. fire Pravin. I get someone who's a bit more less communist.
A liberal concept. Okay, that is a liberal concept, to have a less communist.
A less communist finance minister. That'd be great.
But can we get back onto liberalism? All right. So where else can we look to improve sort of liberal values in society?
Right. Well, something that I'm quite passionate about, I suppose, is the teaching of logic and philosophy, because I think this is just missing. And it's really weird because, I mean, in our daily lives, we are constantly being confronted with arguments. And I think a lot of the time people are, you know, weary of some arguments and they know there's something dodgy going on, but they can't quite put their finger on it. We need to sort of be more critical and be able to voice our criticism and be able to articulate what it is that we find dodgy. And I think that for example, the teaching of logic, certainly more widely than in small philosophy seminars at university, would go down really well.
Was this a colonized or a decolonized university? No, I'm joking. I'm just joining now.
Now you're totally trolling.
Only now.
He hasn't been trolling the whole time
Pravin
at all.
Must go. No, I'm really serious about that. But Jonathan Haidt tells us, right? I mean, people are not swayed by logic. If they were, we wouldn't have any dumb
humans
people.
Aren't rational beings.
Yeah. humans aren't rationalists by any means.
Yeah, except, the problem is we are dealing constantly with seemingly, you know, rational discourse. And so if, you know, people are using arguments, which a lot of people are, even if they aren't, you know, particularly sound rationally, you know, you ought to be able to call out the fallacies that are going on and whatnot.
That's why you must be on Twitter, like us. That would be you on Twitter. Call out fallacies.
Yeah.
That's what you guys
it's
do.
It's a horrible place to be. It's a horrible place to do that work.
Yeah, no, I avoid Twitter.
Right. So logic. So how do you teach it? You say at university, but not at school?
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. I think it's a bit sad that it's constrained to, you know, to universities. I think it could be taught at schools. And I think, in fact, there are quite a lot of studies to show that kids who've been exposed to logic or some basic philosophy are able to, they perform better in various subjects. So it's sort of, you know, you're gaining a life skill because it's, yeah, I mean, philosophy, I suppose, is, it means, you know, the love of wisdom, which is something very different to the love of knowledge, because I think wisdom entails how you look at knowledge and how you evaluate knowledge and how you instrumentalize knowledge. Yeah. So basically,
I do think it's called child abuse these days. If you question a child,
if you question,
and the reason why I'm saying that is because, you know, there's a but it's true. Okay. So there's a guy, a philosopher friend of mine, who I met once. He's at UJ.
Mm-hmm.
And since his daughter was able to talk, he questioned her on everything.
Amazing.
From what she ate for breakfast to what she learned at school to, are you sure this is actually your house? Like, how do you know it's actually your house? No, because I come here every day. Okay, but you know you could be wrong. Mm. No, it could be wrong. Okay, so he questions her every day, not to demean her, but to build up.
So that's not child abuse.
No.
How do you know this is your house, Jane? I mean, seriously.
That's not your
own therapy. Oh my gosh, my father used to question me about whether I actually lived in my own house.
I think that's a good way to build up
logical
premises, even for like a 4 or 5 year old.
Mm. Absolutely. I mean, there are certainly methodologies and techniques of teaching.
You see, I'm not trolling.
No, that was fair. That was. I think it's reasonable.
No, that is totally reasonable.
I just think people are either too scared or not curious at all.
Is that the start of logic? Really, questioning, saying why about things, just in general.
Why.
I mean, kids do this. Although 5 year olds are great at this.
Absolutely.
5 year olds ask why for everything. Yeah.
Exactly.
Having a conversation with someone the other day, and they was around the university stuff that's going on, and they said, the government must fund free education, and I said, why?
Mm.
And that's all I said. I didn't argue.
And then you perpetrated white violence.
I just said why.
Ask me why.
And she couldn't answer the question.
Mm.
You're assuming the person wasn't a white girl. A Wimson. So they haven't messed up the word girl, actually, and boy.
We can use those.
I think it's very important to question people all the time.
Yes.
And it drives people absolutely crazy.
Totally. But I mean, that's the Socratic method, right? Is just to ask questions and keep pushing and asking. I mean, I think Socrates famously said, I can't teach people anything. I can only teach them how to think. And that's what philosophy can do. And that's a wonderful sort of example that you give of these, you know, of kids who just, they always ask why. And I feel like we as adults, you know, could learn a lot actually from
absolutely.
Kids.
Absolutely, we take things for granted.
And I think what we often just don't do is question sort of these fundamental assumptions that are flying around, and that's dangerous. So I think that's when things become dangerous.
Yeah. So don't question me when I say Praveen must go.
You two we just laughed. That is the message for the Renegade Report this week. Be more like a 5 year old.
Brilliant. I can't argue.
That sums it up.
We unfortunately are out of time. Cecilia, you're not on Twitter.
No.
She doesn't want to be found.
She doesn't want to be found. You will find her columns occasionally on Politics Web, right?
Yeah, when I decide to procrastinate.
When you procrastinate, you write
every
columns.
Now and again. You can people find stuff on your NGO's website? Some useful stuff there.
Sort of static, so not.
Not really. All right. Well, go. What about your favorite author? You can plug him a bit. Your favorite philosophers and authors and all that.
Well, John Tidwell.
Exactly. There you go. So go read.
John Rawls.
Go do some reading. That's your homework. I know you're only five, but that's your homework. Thank you so much for listening to the show. As always, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm not even going to tell you the links anymore. I'm sure you know them. Please rate us on iTunes. Tell your friends. Make sure people are listening to the show so they can expand their worldview a little bit. And we'll catch you next time. Cheers. CliffCentral.com.